Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
For us to only say that, well, let's just talk about the economy, let's not talk about race, we fall into the same trap about the arguments about, well, this is an economic issue, this is not a racial issue. When in fact, the people's life experiences are shaped by their identities, and they're more than just their class identities. All of their different identity perspectives come into play, and especially race, and especially because in a country where the schism and divide has been based on a country and a history that is oppressed communities of color, we cannot have just an economic focused message that doesn't also explain and impact communities, how this is going to impact communities of color. And I think that's actually where you've seen a little bit more of a shift, I think, and even some of the left of the Bernie Sanders type of rhetoric, where 2016 having some difficulty connecting with some black voters, and then obviously some of those difficulties continued in 2020. However, more of his messaging as of late has really been tying together economic and racial justice issues.
We were playing catch up during the Thanksgiving period. Sagar went off to Thanksgiving in Costa Rica, so he wasn't exactly able to record any episodes. He also is in the middle of celebrating the 6-month anniversary of Breaking Point, so if people haven't given him any shout outs on the really great success they had over there, please do so. But I had to record an episode because we're committed to continue putting out really great content and conversations. So I thought what I would do is have a follow-up episode to the one I did with John McWhorter, Columbia University professor, New York Times columnist, and author of Woke Racism, which is basically pushing back on modern social justice, civil rights discourse on the left and in the Democratic Party and at places like his employer, the New York Times. This episode is basically taking the complete opposite point of view. I was only able to record for 30 minutes with John, so this is a opportunity to go a little deeper into the topic, but also give a different point of view. If you haven't had a chance to listen to John's episode, do so right afterwards to get both points of views here. Something I'm really excited to do moving forward is do a better job as a show of giving people two sides of two different debates from two different perspectives, because the whole point about our realignment idea and show frame is that we're all trying to come here to figure it out. That means that one guest on one topic is never going to perfectly sum all of that up. But the guest today is Kyle Strickland. He is the Deputy Director for Race and Democracy at the Roosevelt Institute. And he has a really interesting report that he co-authored with the head of the Institute, Felicia Wong. And it's called A New Paradigm for Justice and Democracy, Moving Beyond the Twin Failures of Neoliberalism and Racial Liberalism. We've talked a bit about neoliberalism in the past. It's obviously a buzzword. It sounds a little complicated. What it basically means is free market economics, the type of centrist, even center-left, center-right policies that candidates like Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders on the left and right respectively really pushed back against. The key interesting thing that Kyle and Felicia are bringing to the real fore here is the fact that they think that this pushback against neoliberalism also needs to bring in this idea that racial liberalism, which is basically the idea and the ideology that John was bringing up last week, also were failures. So they think that we're really seeing, in all the chaos we're experiencing in politics, the fact that our economic picture and our racial picture has really just collapsed in and of itself. So once again, great episode, totally different perspective than what we heard last week. I think if we didn't piss people off next week, this would piss some people off. Would love to hear it. Would love feedback, which is an excellent pivot to the rest of our quick shout out. So number one, it's Thursday. That means this is a Substack day. We're sending that Substack out this Thursday afternoon. If you have any thoughts about this episode, please write in quickly so we could include feedback, pushback, whatever in the actual link. You can find this in the show notes or down below on YouTube. Number two, we're getting near the holiday season, Christmas, Hanukkah, pick your poison, whatever you're into. If you are looking for some books and some suggestions, we have really great lists of books from our authors and our personal reading this year. Definitely go check it out. We really loved moving books last holiday season. Finally, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. It's been really helpful this year to have a real strong partner who helped us put together great work like this. Let's get into the episode. Strickland, welcome to The Realignment.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
We're going to spend a lot of time unpacking a really interesting report you put out regarding neoliberalism, basically debates about America's economic structure, and debates about race, liberalism, culture that really matter and a lot of members of the audience are interested in. I want to start by just getting a little bit about your background and where this report is actually coming out of. So you are at the Roosevelt Institute. Would love to just hear a little bit about you, why you were drawn to this work, and the specific deal around the Roosevelt Institute and just the type of work they are doing there.
Of course. Yeah. So first, thanks so much again for having me. So I work at the Roosevelt Institute. We're actually a think tank and nonprofit partner to the FDR Presidential Library and Museum. And so we actually draw upon the legacies, not just of Franklin, but also of Eleanor Roosevelt in terms of re-envisioning and reimagining the economy so that it can work for the many, not the few. And so our focus is really primarily on the types of economic policies that kind of have a reinvigorated New Deal for the 21st century, but also a focus of race and gender consciousness in our work to move forward. And ultimately, the way it ties in with this report is around multiracial inclusive democracy for all of us moving forward and what that looks like. And that ties in to my work as the Deputy Director of Race and Democracy at the Roosevelt Institute, where my work focuses primarily on the latest research on and policy ideas related to race, politics, economics, and our democracy, and fundamentally looking at how today's racial justice movement is pushing a new vision for racial justice in our democracy in the 21st century. So I'm just excited to be here. My background is as an attorney, so I'm a lawyer by trade, but most of my work is focused on legal policy or economic policy as well. So excited for this report, have a lot of experience talking about race and racial justice, and looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, and I'm glad you framed it that way, because I'd want to start by talking about FDR, both as president, as a campaigner, as someone who advanced a very specific critique of an old system and helped build a new one, and then frankly just his legacy, because what's interesting to me here is, how do you all at the Institute think of FDR in the sense that, looking at his legacy, he obviously advanced a very specific new conception of America's economic picture, but at the same time, it doesn't take that, you don't have to spend that time delving into racial justice literature to find a lot of critiques of FDR's policies, but also his style of politics when it came from race. So we'd just love to hear how you think about that through these two specific lenses.
Of course. So it's really important to have a wide-eyed view of the legacy of FDR, and that means taking the good with some of the bad. And part of that, really, when we think about his legacy more broadly, it's really about the transformative vision for America's possibility, what it could accomplish. And it's specifically, we look at it through the lens of economic policy. Really, that's a big lens in which we look at it through. But fundamentally, it's really about public power, the ability to make sure that corporate interest and just concentrated interest at the very top don't exclude and dominate over the voices of everybody else, which is why there's such an emphasis on the ways in which government can actually work for people and not against people. And understanding that to transform the types of system that we have, we can't just have hands off and let the market do everything, because what happens then, you have a small amount of actors, in particular cases, very wealthy and powerful actors that dominate their special interests, get more wealthy, and the rest of us are left off. Where the focus was really about, how do we actually make sure that government can provide a security and safety net and an opportunity for economic rights, those things that are not just going to be rationed off solely to the market, but where government can have a role in the public provisioning of these resources in a more egalitarian way. However, to your point, when it comes to who was excluded from these issues, these are often things that are not talked about a lot in our textbooks, but when we talk about these New Deal era programs, which were massive in transforming the American economic system, the American system of government more broadly, what happened though was that many communities, specifically Black and Brown communities, were excluded from these programs. So we talk about things from Social Security to even the Fair Labor Standards, where what ended up happening was you had folks that were excluded by both design and implementation, because in order to pass many of these New Deal programs, FDR had to make a deal with many Southern Democrats who wanted to keep the Jim Crow era segregation, but were on board with more economic policies that were more liberal economic policies. So what happened then was any program from Social Security to the GI Bill, you actually had programs that fundamentally opened doors of opportunity for the vast majority of white Americans, but left behind black and brown Americans and workers of color. And so what happens then was you saw an entire generation and middle class to expand and build wealth over time, but that wealth wasn't trickled down and passed down to black Americans and other people of color. And so our focus for the 21st century is how do we rewrite some of those wrongs and make sure that both not only through design, but implementation, communities aren't excluded and left to the whims of being on their own. And I think ultimately you can't talk about FDR and the legacy around race and racial justice without reckoning with the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. And these are all instances of a fundamental reckoning that we must make to the tremendous amount of harm that was placed on our communities. And that's something that is part of the legacy. And I think what we're trying to do is learn more and discover more conversations about how we can repair and redress some of those harms in the past and how we can address that moving forward. That's some of the heat themes we highlight in the report as well.
I hope you'll forgive me. You're doing a really great job of just setting this all up. So I'm just going to spend a lot of time asking audience advocacy follow-ups here that are sure at the heart of everyone's minds on these. So let's start here. What can modern civil rights activists and frankly economic policy activists, let's say people of the left on economics, what can they learn from FDR's pragmatism? Because for good or for ill, I don't think if you look at the discourse that comes from racial justice conversations, there is much rhetorical focus on pragmatism. It's hard to look at summer 2020, once again, whether you support the policies or not, and think that the rhetoric and the activists were focused on those pragmatic deals in the same way that FDR was making deals with racist segregationists. So how can we, what do you learn from that? How should we learn from that? Are the stakes different now? Is there a set of issues where it makes sense to compromise? Are there issues where it doesn't make sense? How do you think of that?
Yeah, so I think about this in the context of where people find themselves on the particular political spectrum, in the sense that you have a variety of different stakeholders who are constantly trying to push the realm of what's possible, right, and what is deemed pragmatic. And so, for example, when we talk about the FDR era, you know, you have a situation in the 30s and early 40s where a lot of the civil rights focus and racial justice advocates at the time had been really pushing and fighting for and fighting for anti-lynching legislation. This has been something that they were pushing for in the era of horrific lynchings that were going on all across the country, but especially in the American South. And what they were pushing for was types of federal legislation that would come in and prosecute lynching as crimes and hold people accountable for lynching. However, many times, and even in this case, you had Eleanor Roosevelt, who was writing and supporting campaigns to support anti-lynching legislation. But what happened when this was happening? Well, the filibuster that we talk about often today was used to block anti-lynching legislation back then, just as that filibuster is being used to block progress on voting rights and all sorts of things today. But what you see then is a situation in which advocates had to really readjust on what was possible at the time. So you're always going to have people who are pushing at the edges to say that these are the things, these are rights we should have always had and we don't have right now. So we need federal government who can help enforce some of these rights to make that happen. And so you're always going to have that pushing on that lever against lynching. At the same time that these things were happening, you had other racial justice advocates that were pushing against segregation, right? How do we dismantle segregation? And a couple different ways they could do it. One was through education. And that's where we saw the groundwork for Brown v. Board. But we also saw the Montgomery bus boycotts in the early 50s. And all these things were laying towards that groundwork. And so the question was, What did FDR, how did he work within the system? So you had to work and operate with senators who were segregationists and who wanted to uphold a system of racial hierarchy and white supremacy in the South. And yet we needed these economic policies to move forward on. You had a president who was willing to buck the conventional wisdom in many ways. When we talked about the conversations around Supreme, you know, potential to pack the Supreme Court and really thinking about the different ways so that he articulated a new vision for how we were going to talk about our politics. So it was a lot of strong-arming politics in many ways. But I think it's illuminating for the debates we're having today, because the debates we're having today is this, right? When we speak about pragmatism, when we speak about what's practical, that is for our policymakers to ultimately make a decision based on within the context of our politics. Even the some of the demands that a lot of the folks in the racial justice movement were making 10, 5 years ago wouldn't even be thought possible to be in the conversation today. But it happened because you had people who were pushing on the edges. And then slowly you see within the mainstream, those making those arguments of, well, how do we actually get that in a Senate? And then within a Supreme Court system that we have right now, how do you get that within state legislatures across the country? So I don't worry too much about those who are pushing on the edges, because I think the concept of what's pragmatic is really on the basis of what we deem pragmatic as a politics. And I think you see push further to the left, just as you see pushes further to the right. And I think there you have to have a center of folks who are able to reach across the divide on a set of issues. But I think we can't compromise on things like, should we have a democracy or not? Those are things we don't need to compromise on, but we can compromise on the ways in which how much spending we're going to put towards a particular program, how a particular program is going to be implemented. That's where we need to have pragmatic debates and conversations among policymakers as well.
Could you define what you mean by democracy? Because what's interesting here is that, and this tends to switch depending on who's in political power or not, but you could very easily argue, and I'm sure you do argue, that the filibuster is anti-democratic. But there are definitely Republicans and conservatives who are part of this audience who'd say, actually, A, America isn't literally a democracy. It's a democratic republic and a part of a Democrat. And I'm not trying to play the gotcha game,
for sure,
but
for
part
sure.
of what a conservative's definition, and once again, people get hypocritical once positions switch. So let's just be good faith here. I don't want to, I know some people are thinking that right now too, but I could see someone arguing good faith. Kyle, my interpretation of a democratic republic is that you have a filibuster because a filibuster protects the rights of a minority. So what, when you say the word democracy and when you're talking about principles that undergird that, what does that look like? Because my concern is that too often the conversation on democracy gets really sort of constrained around a set of specific policies, yay or nay, when I think we should be having a more first principles argument. So I'd love to hear what yours are.
Yeah, no, it's a great, and it's a great point about the good faith arguments, because there are obviously a lot of folks who don't have these arguments in good faith. But I think there is this fundamental idea around, well, what does it mean democracy exactly and for who, right? I think the question really is ultimately about power and about having the ability to have say and over the shape and structure of your life and your communities and a particular community. And so I think that's why it's important when we think about democracy, whether it's small d democracy, when we think about that concept, it isn't just within the context of the United States, but it's also within how does that operate within our particular communities, right? You have communities that have centers of democratic power at the grassroots level. We see elements of participatory democracy in all aspects of the things that we do, which is simply, in really, in many cases, majority rule, but at the end of the day, making sure that we have protections of the rights of minorities and communities so that they aren't only the voice of the majority and those in the minority are left behind. And what's important about this is that I would make the argument that the filibuster and ways in which it is used today is anti-democratic. However, the way in which the filibuster in of itself as designed as a protection against a particular majority in a particular situation, let's say in the Senate that has majority control. And so the question is, well, who's in power and who's not? And why are you pro filibuster when your party's not in power, but you're vice versa, right? What we're seeing, though, is a weaponization of these institutional mechanisms and procedural rules that have fundamentally put in place minority rule in place of majority rule. And so the question isn't just about protection of minority. That is critical. That is a critical safeguard to our democracies, ensuring the protections of all people, ensuring that people have a voice. But to move legislation forward, to move policies forward, to move the reflections of the will of the people in a particular country, in a particular democracy, you have to have a mechanism to make decisions. And the mechanism to make those decisions that we have founded in this republic has been based on majority rule. But what has occurred then is you have a smaller concentration in which a minority is ultimately ruling over the decisions of the majority. And that's where we find ourselves today, in which these are concentrated interests. And that's why democracy is at stake. And this is so critical when we talk about the context of a multiracial, multi-ethnic, egalitarian democracy for us moving forward. We can't talk about our democracy without understanding the notion that here in America, we only have had really a multiracial democracy for the past 65 years since the Voting Rights Act, right? And so for the vast majority of the American Republic and our democracy, it has been mostly a white, wealthy, and typically male, particular faith, Protestant Christians as the purveyors of minority rule in our democracy. So I think we have to have fundamental questions about what it means to expand the franchise, to have a voice and a vote in these particular situations. And our democracy right now is being undermined because minority protection is one thing, but minority rule is an entirely different thing. And that's at the fundamental threat to a democracy based on majority rule.
And I'm glad you brought up local communities because it gets to, I think, the perfect point of tension. And you saw this during the Virginia political race with the debates over the roles of school boards. So former Governor McAuliffe, he had that. And I think he didn't quite mean to say it as aggressively as he did, but he essentially said something on the lines of like parents effectively shouldn't determine local curriculums. And I think once again, I'm being generous in good faith here. I think the reason why he so aggressively stated that is that there's a tension within the ideas you're just talking about, which is why. So perfect example. How should school boards work? I'll ask the question directly. So for example, let's say we're talking about equity, we're talking about equality. There are curriculums that school boards, that teachers, institutions put together that feature specific perspectives on race in America. When it comes to a local community, what is the role of a parent and what is the role of an educator in these contexts where I don't think you could quite say this is about expertise? So I just, because what I really want to say there is I think there's a difference between a debate over racial justice curriculum and the teaching of evolution. I just think these are entirely different issues. And I think that nuance has to be made there. But I'm just curious how you think about it.
Yeah. So in this particular instance, when you talk about school boards and part of the representative democracy we have more broadly is that you have a local community who are paying taxes within that particular school district, who are citizens of that particular school district or are living in that community, who vote on representatives to represent them and their interests at school board and to help and make decisions and input on things like curriculum, but also things like how the financing works in a particular school, how the administration works, hiring, firing in particular schools. But a part of that, though, is that this is all one part of a larger puzzle within our community, which is fundamentally, when you're talking about our schools, when you're talking about the safety, security, the education, and well-being of our children, everybody has a stake in that, and especially our parents, our families, and our communities have a stake in the well-being of their own children and the children within that school district in particular. So it has to be broader than just you kind of hand this off and then you vote in a particular election and then you leave that up to the school board. It is critical that parents have voices and have a say as well as the children, the students have a say in what is being taught in their schools. Now, you do have a broader question that I think you get to, which is when you get to these subjects of intense debate around what types of curriculum is going to be designed within, what are we teaching within our schools? you do have a broader conversation about having both public input, because you have state legislatures who make state standards at the curriculum, at the state level, about the types of curriculum that you'll have. You have those state standards at a play. And then at the local level, you have to make sure that you're working within the nuances of each community. That's why we have the systems that we have, which is every community is not the same. So you have particular needs in a particular community. As a result of that, you have to have the flexibility to make these choices based on classroom, based on school district, based on the particular school building that might have a different set based on the particular neighborhood and area that they are in, based on what the parents have called for and what the students are asking for. And so I think everybody has to have a say in that decision. But ultimately, you do have to have a baseline for what we are teaching. And these are standards that are set by our policymakers. And so that's where I would ultimately see where that battle is had. But if you have teachers, if you have parents who do not like what is being taught in schools, or who want to push a particular agenda in their particular schools, they have the opportunity to debate at school board meetings. They have the opportunity to have these conversations and to testify. And the question is, are our elected leaders, are they listening to our parents, our students, and our teachers? That's what it's designed and should be set up to be. And so I think, you know, McCullough's remarks on this, I think were not good. I don't think those remarks were helpful at all. But I also think in his broader context, I think to his specifics were more so around those parents who had a particular ideology that they were trying to push and push against, more so than just a broader general conversation about racial equality in our schools. On top of this all, it has been weaponized. This has been weaponized. I think you could have most conversations at school board. You and I could have a conversation. Folks could have a conversation about what's being taught in schools. And you're going to find nuance in those conversations. But when you're seeing this big national debate about it, it's much harder to have a nuanced conversation.
I'll just ask the obvious question then. To what degree do you think your side of these debates, I don't mean this negatively, weaponizes with language itself? So for example, isn't it just as reasonable to say that, look, the right is weaponizing CRT? Is the left not weaponizing racial discourse when they say words like anti-racism, when you talk about things such as structural racism? Like, what's the dividing line between, because once again, like, I entirely get why anyone like left of center, even plenty of people in the center, could say the right really weaponized in bad faith debates around justice, racial justice in school. But I could see a bunch of people center to the right also saying, we feel as if racial policies are weaponized so that you can't have a nuanced conversation about affirmative action, reparations, et cetera, et cetera. What would you say to those people?
Yeah, what I'd say to those making that argument is that this is not a both sides type of argument. Is that, you know, there are certainly folks who on the left who kind of police the discourse in terms of what you can or cannot say and how to say a particular thing and whether or not you are quote unquote politically correct or not on a particular thing, but. In many cases, some of those are made in bad faith, right? And some of those are more performative than not, to maybe show that, hey, you know, this is where I stand on a particular issue, and if you don't, if you're not standing on the same moral high ground as I am, then somehow there's something wrong with you. I think that's more extreme. I think that's actually my personal belief. I think that's overblown. Yes, I believe that exists. I believe that there are those who police the rhetoric of certain folks who are making arguments or making comments in good faith, or even that have been maybe misinformed by some of this weaponization that I'm talking about. And they should not be condemned as an individual or acclaimed as a racist or anything like that. But my argument is that those conversations about tactics, about strategy, about certain word choices have been done to basically try to overcorrect or to address some of the attacks that we have seen on the far right. And what I mean by that is that the weaponization is what I mean, because there is a particular political ideology that is being pushed. And especially when we talk about critical race theory, which is to completely distort its meaning of what it's actually designed to do, to then create and cause fear and to build and buy and prey on people's fears, as well as racial resentments, to ultimately push an agenda that is basically at the heart against a more progressive, expansive, egalitarian vision for society. So, for example, when we talk about critical race theory being lumped in with social emotional learning, somehow having conversation about social emotional learning is now deemed as something that is going too far. I think when you step back at this, it's really fundamentally a question about what is the role of government? What is the role of public power more broadly in our community's lives, in both advancing justice, but also the conversations in which we determined who gets economic policies, who gets social policies, how we want to govern ourselves. These are all questions that are fundamentally about ideology and the role of government and the role of our communities. And I think, you know, it's easy to say, well, this side does this too, and this side does it too. But when you have one side that is funded by, in many cases, a propaganda machine and a media network that funds that those efforts, I think it's completely lopsided, more so than, you know, racial justice advocates over here trying to police somebody's rhetoric. That's kind of where I'd have that conversation. I think most Americans are in that kind of middle area. I do believe that there's center left folks who have these different policies and beliefs about what we want as a society. But I do think the weaponization is coming from the far right.
I'm glad you talked about center left folks, because the specific type of person I'm bringing up, it might not be the majority, but it exists. What do you say to a Virginia voter who voted for Biden, dislikes Trump, but voted for Youngkin over some of the debates that you're basically articulating here? Because I think that if we're talking about where a lot of these fights over everything, and we will get to the report in the second half of the episode.
Yeah.
But if we're looking at where a lot of these fights are clearly going to be fought, they're going to be focused on that type of voter. What would you say to that voter directly?
Well, one, I completely understand. You know, the facts are that, to be very clear, every election is different, right? And I think it's really important for us to understand that you can't just see what happens in the past election and then project that onto the next election and thinking, well, this is what happened. This is why you see so much emphasis on, well, you know, you had Obama to Trump voters, and then you had Obama, Trump to Biden voters. And now you have this Biden, you know, anti-Trump, but pro Glenn Youngkin. I think it's important for us to not extrapolate too much on this one election on what this means for 22 and beyond. But what I will say is this, is that you can't just run on an anti-Trump message, because one, in many ways, in cases where Trump was actually on the ballot in 2020. And so an anti-Trump message and a pro Biden or a vision for America that was not Trump, that was a message that resonated with the vast majority of Americans and ultimately led to Joe Biden being elected president of the United States. But in 2021 in Virginia, when it's not a national debate and it's happening in Virginia and particular focus on those issues, and you have a candidate who is not named Donald Trump, who is on the ballot, who is very different from Donald Trump. And as much as Trump would like, would hate to admit it, is Youngkin distanced himself in many ways from Donald Trump. He still talked about things like critical race theory. He still talked about these issues, but it was done so in a way that could connect to a voter that was turned off by the ugliness and divisiveness of that types of anti-Trump politics, but even the type of Trumpist politics, which is really ugly type of rhetoric, who's turned off by that, who saw Glenn Youngkin, who saw, hey, this is a businessman. This is somebody who understands and could connect with my students, with my communities, even though that I personally believe has an agenda that in many ways pushes this broader ideology that you know, I would say Trump doesn't really have a clear ideology, to be frank. But he is pushing this broader ideology of the conservative right. And what I would say is that if you're going to have these conversations, these elections, you have to meet people where they are. It doesn't mean you accept everybody's viewpoints, but you meet people where they are and get an understanding of why it is they come to believe a certain thing. And there's a variety of reasons for that. One is your own upbringing, your own communities that you're surrounded by, who you hang out with, who you spend time with, but then also the media environment you find yourselves in. All these things impact the ways in which you make your decisions day in and day out. And some voters made the decision on election day of here's who they were going to vote for. And so I think as progressives, and whether you're progressive or whether you're more center left, we have to understand that there's so much nuance in this. You have to organize communities. You have to talk with voters, and you can't assume that they're with you. And so it can't just be a game of just saying, hey, we're only going to turn out our base. You also have to not just take your base for granted, right? You have to have a game of persuasion that talks about why not only should you vote for us, but we will actually be able to deliver for you. And then I think what a lot of voters are saying is that change doesn't happen overnight. So Biden gets elected president, and then it's November 2021, and many people are still facing these larger circumstances that they're in, and they might place blame on Biden or on Democrats for why we have these situations. And so people vote for change. That's why the party in power typically does not do well in midterm elections. But my argument would be, you know, there are better ways to have a conversation at why people are feeling the economic pain that they're feeling, why they're feeling these conversations that are divisive that are happening at their local levels. And we can't just expect people are going to think, oh, our messaging is perfect and they're going to go vote for us. No, you have to deliver for people. And you also have to understand where they're coming from. And we have to do a better job of that. And it means talking about race. We, in many cases, we don't directly talk about these issues. And what happens is it's filled in the vacuum. The most vile rhetoric can be filled in the vacuum. And if somebody else comes in and says, hey, I just want to have a colorblind society and, you know, all sorts of things like that, it can sound appealing if you're not having the counter argument of what that actually means in our particular schools.
I'm glad you put it that way, because honestly, like, why do we have to talk about race? Now, I'm being very specific when I say talk about race, because from my political perspective, what McAuliffe should have been talking about was, and this is probably more focused on Biden because this is the national politics side, hey, we get that people want to go back to normal with COVID. That's why we're focusing on that. Hey, we get people are worried about the supply chain crisis. We're working on that. Hey, we get that there are these problems, whether it's like infrastructure or the economy. We're working on those. As a political project, how does discussing race in a hyper-polarized country like ours help advance the broader work you're doing?
Of course. So the way we do this is by understand, this is why, you know, we argue about moving beyond kind of these paradigms of how we talk about racial politics in America, which is we have to understand that racial justice, you know, that is linked with all of these other issues. So when we're talking about the economy, when we're talking about equality more broadly, when we're talking about the issues that impact people and people's lives, we have to be talking about the reality of the communities that we're in a democracy and in a society that we are in, a diverse country. We have to talk about race and the multi-ethnic, multi-racial identities that we have. And there is a tendency not to, because it's such an uncomfortable conversation topic to have, but you can't just talk about race alone and not have connections to anything else, because then that's when people rightfully will say, well, you're bringing race into everything. What does this have to do with X, Y, or Z? And if you don't make that connection to why this matters, and why this is important for us to have a conversation, then people aren't going to be able to understand, well, why are we even talking about this in the first place? Because we have a very limited perspective about racial inequality in this country. The facts are, and that's why it's so important to teach about race and our racial history. Most people see racism as acts of individual discrimination. So they think, well, you know, so-and-so, you know, had, you know, said a racial slur, you know, they're, you know, they support the KKK. That's the kind of white supremacist racism that we see. And we don't condone that as an American society. We're better than that. We don't believe in that. We believe everybody's equal. So we say that in a very broad context. But what we don't talk about is the ways in which this history has led to racialized outcomes that have discriminated against people based on the color of their skin because of the laws and policies that we have to advantage certain people at the exclusion of others. And this not only operates within the racial context, but this operates within our economic context. Our system is set up to have more protection and power and interest to those who have more wealth and more power than the rest of us. And I think for us, we have to move beyond this conversation that racial justice over here, economic justice over here, and talk about how racial justice, racial equality helps all of us. This moves past the zero-sum arguments that some would like us to have. And I think it requires those who authentically understand, right? I'm not asking for folks to just talk about race to talk about race. We don't want people just doing that if they don't authentically believe in what they're saying. What we need them to know and realize is that they understand that people have different lived experiences based on how they are treated, based on the color of their skin, based on their background, their circumstances, and that as a society and as a country, we have to make sure that we're leveling the playing field and we're making opportunity available for all people, regardless of background, regardless of circumstance. And because we are not yet there, we are not yet in that aspirational world, we have to talk about the barriers. Because here's the thing, if we don't talk about those barriers that exist, then people see the inequality that exists right now and they say, well, that's the fault of an individual, or that's that's their own responsibility that they've got to worry about. That's the pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. When we know as a country that there have been too many people left behind because of very policies that have pushed against people. And so I think we talk about race by connecting it to economic issues and connecting it to people's lived experiences. But you shouldn't just talk about race in the abstract. You have to make connections with people's everyday lives. That's why I think Heather McGee, with her phenomenal book, Some of Us, talks about the connection between race and the economy and how our fates are linked. Talking about race isn't just about people of color. It's also about white people too, right? And so we, all of us fit into this picture of what a more diverse, equitable society can look like. And that's how you have a nuanced, important discussion. And not everybody can do it. And so I wouldn't just advise everybody just talk about race, but talk about it. It's authentic and true to you, and can connect to voters on the ground.
Here's the example I'm wondering with, and push back if this is unfair, because people hate hypotheticals. I'm thinking of what you're saying, and two very specific examples came to mind. So I recently lived in Washington, D.C. I spent a lot of time in Baltimore. A like infrastructure, clear racial justice issue is the absolutely like unconscionable amount of lead in like pipes in the city of Baltimore. I think that's the prime uncontestable. If you ever want to talk to someone who's like skeptical of like, you know, racial disparity issues, you just bring up this example. I've yet to hear someone just say that's insane. Mm-hmm. In very specific, very black parts of the town, there's literally just too much lead pipes in a way that just doesn't exist in the vast majority of more wider parts of the country. Also, you had the example where Pete Buttigieg, and he got dunked on for this, but this is a real example of, you know, the Robert Caro cited example of bridges and various parts of our infrastructure being designed in a way that were meant to be exclusionary. The example being the certain infrastructure was designed so that persons of color, like children's buses, couldn't access certain parts of the city. These exist. These are real. They have to be addressed. I guess my question, though, for you is at a political level, and this is why I'm obsessed with the FDR connection here.
Yep.
How did talking about either example make the infrastructure bill pass? Because I get what you're saying about how you need to go into communities and you need to meet community members where they are. But the objection to Build Back Better, the skepticism of Pete Buttigieg wasn't coming from majority black districts. You don't need to go talk to black people about the need for infrastructure. You don't need to go to some corner of Queens or Brooklyn or like the Bronx and say, hey, like racial justice things matters. And frankly, like the type of white voters who, frankly, like you see this in my name, but I'm adopted. I'm from like Portland, Oregon. My NPR New Yorker reading parents are already like deeply aware of these arguments. They're the ones who taught me this argument. So what white people are convinced by the examples we're talking about versus just saying, hey, wouldn't we all want to live in a society where our roads weren't broken? I guess that's what I'm just kind of trying to get at. I'm just like, politically, how is race, and I don't want to say racializing, that makes it seem like I'm accusing you of something. How does discussing infrastructure issues in a racial context change the dynamic when the people who aren't voting for it are centrist Democrats and moderate Republicans?
Yeah. So the important thing is this. I mean, there's always a conversation about the nuance and the context in which you're operating in, right? And so, you know, in particular cases, if you need a set of people to vote for a particular bill and a certain argument is going to work for them, then you can make that argument. But I think what's important is that for a long time in our politics, we have avoided talking about these issues for this very reason. This idea, well, you know, if we talk about these issues, then somehow it's going to create this broader divide. And as a result, we're not going to get the things passed that is going to help all of us. The fact is that we have to shift the terms of the debate. You know, we have to talk about who this is going to impact and making sure that it's not just about race. So race is key and critical because that's a person's identity and perspective, but it's also about different impacts. And that's why when we talk about Build Back Better, about how this would impact those, not only communities of color, but those who continue to be marginalized in our society, especially women, right? And addressing our care industry, our care economy more broadly. Those are the things that it's shifting the terms of the debate. And I would actually argue that the infrastructure package, I don't think would have passed had it not been conceptualized as packaged together with the Build Back Better bill. Because you had progressives who said the infrastructure was not going far enough. We needed to do this. Now we have this broader, you know, we see what's at play is you have some Republicans who will vote for infrastructure, but those who are not going, obviously going to vote for a Build Back Better. The conversation that we have to have is we have to push the dialogue further about who this is going to impact. And I think if we are in the old paradigm, I'm with you on this. I think if you're operating in that paradigm, which says, don't talk about race, the second you talk about race, it blows everything up. I think you're working within a paradigm in which you cannot have nuanced conversations and dialogue. Because even if, let's say somebody, you know, let's say I'm a politician who believes in racial justice and equality, but I represent voters who maybe aren't quite there with me on these issues, I don't want to lean in or lead with that issue, right? That's something that you might not want to lead with. But I think we are moving in a direction in which we have to have a more nuanced dialogue that says talking about racial justice, talking about these issues is about how it's impacting people's lived experiences. And this impacts you as well. That's why I think the conversation around broadband, universal broadband is so important, because not only are we talking about how this impacts urban communities and communities of color, but also rural communities. It's also important for us not to just put people in boxes, right? Because people talk about urban communities as if it's just communities of color, rural communities have just white rural communities, when this impacts people of all different backgrounds. And I think it helps us move in a direction that makes race not just a central component of it, but a critical component of it. That's not something that can be siloed. And I think we'll get there. I don't think you lead with it only. But you have to talk about who it's going to impact and why it's important for you and why it impacts you and your family. And I think you can have that conversation in a nuanced way. I think if you just have it in broad strokes, this is going to help certain people who are quote unquote undeserving, which has been deeply racialized from our weaponized politics. I think that gets into these larger arguments. But we need to talk about how our policies, our practices moving forward should help all people. And that includes people who have been disproportionately impacted. I think we can have that debate. I think America's ready. Now, whether individual policymakers are is another question.
Let me just put on my socialist hat for a quick second. That's sort of the audience has been very underserved today. Why isn't the answer to all this just a real like class-based working class? There's this interesting debate you see on the left. And I don't just mean like your normal, I mean like the left. Where they basically say, look, Kyle, like you said at the start of the episode, the flaw of FDR was that he didn't extend Social Security to black workers in the South enough. The flaw of our system is that not enough people have access to universal health care. So how do you think about these debates between these debates? Because I know you're saying that we shouldn't just treat economics and racial justice as separate, But the reason why we do, or at least the reason why a lot of people feel the need to, is that if you're looking at the actual culture war polarization of these issues, the communities that many people, for example, many very, very online Bernie Sanders supporters, the communities that they feel their policies would be most appealing to, universal healthcare, vastly expanded governmental spending, they think those communities are also very allergic to racial political rhetoric. So what is your argument? And this, so I'm speaking quite purely to the left. What is your, so we kind of respond to the center and to the right, but what is your response to left people who just say the lesson of FDR was that he didn't go far enough on economics, and by addressing these class issues, we will also, which would include vast infrastructure spending that would affect the lead pipes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do you say to them?
Yeah, I mean, if we don't talk about racial justice, we don't talk about race, then what ends up happening is you could have quote unquote universal policies that are disproportionately implemented based on the racial disparities that we see today. And the reason why it's important to make those connections is because it's really about the lived experiences of communities. And that means more than just economic policy, economic policy without talking about race and how this is going to impact people. And the reason that is because you also have to tie in to ultimately how this connects to the types of political power that people and communities are building. And because of the historical experiences, because of the marginalization of our communities that have been not just on class, but also on race, you have to identify race-conscious economic policies that address that past issue. So when we talk about FDR, address some of those exclusions. Because otherwise, moving forward, what is, you know, why do you have a particular remedy that is race-conscious is because of these specific actions that have happened in the past. And for us to only say that, well, let's just talk about the economy, let's not talk about race, we fall into the same trap about the arguments about, well, this is an economic issue, this is not a racial issue, when in fact, the people's life experiences are shaped by their identities, and they're more than just their class identities. All of their different identity perspectives come into play, and especially race, and especially because in a country where the schism and divide has been based on a country and a history that is oppressed communities of color, we cannot have just an economic focused message that doesn't also explain and impact communities, how this is going to impact communities of color. And I think that's actually where you've seen a little bit more of a shift, I think, and even some of the left of the Bernie Sanders type of rhetoric, where 2016, having some difficulty connecting with some Black voters, and then obviously some of those difficulties continued in 2020. However, more of his messaging as of late has really been tying together economic and racial justice issues. With that said, there is a conversation about how and when to speak about these issues and to do so authentically. And that's why I think you have people who are able to talk about their own lived experiences and why this matters, more so than just in the abstract. And that's why I actually think these debates on the left and on the right, you know, these are very abstract theoretical debates. When we're having these conversations, we are including race, we're including the economy, we're including gender. These are perspectives that we have into account. And the question is, well, what do you lead with? That's why, you know, people are talking about things like the race class narrative. People have conversations about, well, maybe let's just have a class only focus and that can bring our solidarity together. But I think even having a racial justice focus, it must go beyond just the economy. So how are we talking about our democracy? Who has power in our democracy more broadly? You have to talk about how this history in this country and in today's efforts have been to exclude certain people based on the color of their skin, regardless of economic status, regardless of economic status. So, you know, that's why those who are the most well off, who are still of a particular background, the color of their skin, face disparities and discrimination that others might not face. So it's a much deeper issue than economic inequality. That's why when you cover for education level. So for example, one of the studies that's really impactful, Dr. Derek Hamilton talks a lot about, is how you could have a situation where a Black head of the household who graduated with a college degree has less wealth on average than a white head of the household who dropped out of high school. So it's more than just, you know, how are we, you know, leveling the economic playing field? Is education leveling the economic playing field? if you're not talking about the ways in which racial stratification has impacted communities and where they are today, then we're not going to get the economic equality that even some progressives want without talking about race.
You know, this is a good closing question that gets to a good chance for you to pitch your report, but also really speaks to the tensions we've discussed today, which is something that's really interesting, is that if, to give a quick summary, you and Felicia Wong are arguing that we are really seeing in our discontent today how racial liberalism and then this like neoliberal economic paradigm, like post-1960s, post-1970s, are just collapsing. What I want to understand then, and you made the very valid point that we shouldn't overread into elections, but I think at a narrative level, it's helpful. If that is true, why is Joe Biden president right now? In the sense that Joe Biden is basically the embodiment of racial liberalism. He, in terms of his actual political record, is the, and frankly, when the time he was vice president was probably like, if you think about it, racial liberalism's, Barack Obama's election was almost certainly racial liberalism's high watermark in terms of like a very well-deserved, impressive achievement. Looking at his economic policies, he's very centrist, very neoliberal. Why did black voters in the South, why does just the embodiment of the two forces that you argue are on their way out, why is he president right now? And what does that mean for a lot of the failed attempts to win that Democratic primary? You saw a bunch of candidates in different ways try to pick things up. So Bernie Sanders, like you said, 2020, he's much more quote unquote like woke and engaged in racial justice issues than he was in 2016. That didn't work. Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, just love to hear your closing thoughts and then explain the context why this all takes us out too.
Yeah. So, you know, the big thing is that, you know, paradigm shifts don't happen overnight. And so, you know, where we are finding ourselves is, you know, we write about how the election of Barack Obama is really, as you mentioned, kind of this high watermark for racial liberalism, this idea that, you know, we as a country could move forward and advance when it comes to racial equality, because we've accessed an opportunity has been sufficient. We've made gains within the civil rights movement and the civil rights era. And here, a perfect representation and symbolism of that is the nation's first black president. And that certainly represents a huge mark and achievement in our country's racial history. But at the same time, we also saw the setting off of racist backlash and pushback against this representation as an individual figure to these broader issues. And we continue to see vast racial disparities and police violence and all sorts of things that were continuing to happen within our communities. And that's why it's so important when we think about these situations that it has to go beyond just the individual, right? It really is looking at these systemic forces that are at play, which is why we speak in kind of these terms around paradigms and worldviews, right? We have been in a dominant paradigm that basically says, let's not talk about race. Let's say everybody's equal. Let's kind of leave things up to the market to solve our problems, and access and opportunity will be available to all, and everybody can achieve the American dream. What we are seeing is an undoing of that promise, because we have seen that these promises have not been met. People are working hard, working two or three jobs and still not making ends meet. And we still see these massive disparities on a racial and economic level. And so why do we argue that these paradigms are falling? Well, because we are seeing arguments that have been made on the left and within the racial justice movement that are pushing into the mainstream. They're making these arguments that this is not just about individualized racism. This is about deep systemic racism that has been baked in with a system, and seeing how this is existing and permeating throughout society and how we have to address these broader issues. And people are pushing against the paradigms. And at the same time, on the far right, you are having people who are using overt bigotry, overt racism, all sorts of things that was deemed on the sideline of our politics, at least within the mainstream, that is entering into the mainstream and into the rank and file, in many cases, of the Republican Party, where you have this type of rhetoric largely still pushed away. You can't be overtly racist and overtly bigoted. However, the permission structure has been opened. And so what happens in this vacuum is what's going to take forth and move forward. And we think a new paradigm is necessary. We see it on the horizon. The racial justice movement is pushing for that. But the exact confines, the exact pieces of what that looks like are not there just yet. And they're not going to happen overnight. So that's why somebody like a Joe Biden, to be very clear, Joe Biden has been open to evolving views on this kind of neoliberal perspective that he's been part of and this racially liberal perspective to open doors for what's possible. And you had a lot of voters who might believe this, right? Especially when we talk about Black Americans and other people of color, a lot of them in many ways see these issues as real, but they don't know what is possible within our concentrated or in our politics. And they wanted people, they wanted somebody who is going to beat Donald Trump. And they believe that you had to have a voter who's going to be able to connect with people in different ways, who's going to be meet people where they are. And you had somebody like Joe Biden who represented that stability figure after years of chaos under Donald Trump. And so that's kind of where that happens. However, I think we're moving into the case where even figures like Joe Biden are talking about things that wouldn't otherwise would be deemed radical in 2016 and are now mainstream today. And I think you're going to see more of that moving forward. And hopefully we have a more equitable democracy, but we also see some very real forces on the right that are threatening to racial progress and racial justice, which is why it's important to fight for equality and equity in our communities.
Very well said. Kyle, thank you so much for joining. Would love for you to give a quick shout out to the report. We will have it included in the show notes that everyone should check out if they want to learn more, but this is a great place to leave it.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Definitely check out A New Paradigm for Justice and Democracy, really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, that was great. Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.